Well, hello there, and welcome to the Special Ed Strategist Podcast. I am your host, Wendy Taylor. Our episode today is really special to me. Our guest, Annie Tolkien, was my first guest ever when I started this podcast. And to think how far we have grown in our knowledge and expanding our reach to listeners like you. So today, Annie is back. We are exploring the intricate journey of preparing for college with physical disabilities and health conditions. One crucial aspect of this transition is to understand the hidden work parents do for their students, known as what Annie refers to as shadow work. And this often involves tasks like medication refills, doctor's appointments, meal preparations. And so by doing this, parents, we often unintentionally foster that dependency by shouldering these responsibilities without involving our kiddos. So we're going to talk about the essentials to gradually including your student in this discussion and helping them comprehend the effort behind these tasks so that they can gradually themselves start assuming these responsibilities and be prepared for that transition. Annie and I are also going to talk about starting the college transition process early, and that goes for all students, right? But really to ensure that students with physical disabilities and health conditions have that necessary support and accommodations that align with their needs. Annie also dives into transitioning to adulthood. There's some common myths out there of what that would look like if you are a student that is actively receiving support through a public school system prior to graduating high school. The federal law switches a little bit and what implications that may have on your student. So before we dive in to this special episode, I want to let you know that today is brought to you by Learning Essentials. Learning Essentials is a team of advanced degrees special educators aiming to bridge learning gaps through dyslexia intervention, strategic writing instruction, and executive function support, also helping you access special education services through IEP coaching. Visit the link in our show notes for more information on how Learning Essentials can support your kiddo's educational journey. I also have a huge favor to ask. Don't forget to hit that like button, follow, or share. Send this to a friend, somebody that's needing a little extra knowledge. That would be phenomenal. I'd be internally grateful. It would mean the world to me. So as we continue the conversation, join us. You can also find us on at Learning Essentials over on Instagram. Now let's dive in. Welcome, everyone. I am excited to have Annie Tolkien on the show with me. And if you've been around for a minute, I was letting Annie know that she was my first guest. So this is a reunion tour right now. Super excited about that. And it was in October of 2019 when the podcast went live. So here we are years later, we're going to catch up with Annie and get down and dirty on how to transition with physical disabilities and health conditions. So welcome, Annie.
Thanks, Wendy. Yeah, it's our Eras tour for all the Swifties out there. We're going to reboot
stadiums. We're selling out stadiums.
Yeah, it's exciting.
It is exciting. So Annie, let me ask you a quick question before I have you introduce yourself. What is something that our listeners may not know about you that has nothing to do with your job?
Oh, that's a great question. Your listeners may not know that I lived for 3 years in Mongolia. I was a Peace Corps volunteer in Mongolia, 2003 to 2005. And then later on, I was a Fulbright Fellow in Mongolia from 2007 to 2008, where I studied Mongolian teachers' perceptions of disability in the classroom. And fun fact, I actually took my husband on our honeymoon to Mongolia in the winter, where it was like minus 30 degrees. And we've been married for 10 years. So he stayed. So that was a good test. Yeah.
I'm thinking that's not romantic. That's freezing.
Well, it makes you get closer together, Wendy. That's for sure.
Good point. Good point.
Very, 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 very cold. Yes.
Very cold. And what a great story. And I'm sure you were able to explore and learn a ton. And I'm sure some of that is transferred to what you do now. So tell us a little bit about who you are and what you do.
Sure. So I'm Annie Tolkien. I am the founder and director of Accessible College. At Accessible College, I provide college transition support in preparation for students with physical disabilities. So that includes mobility device users, wheelchair users, students with visual impairments and hearing impairments, and also students with chronic health conditions. And that can be things like POTS, Ehlers-Danlos syndrome, Crohn's, diabetes, migraine disorders, anything that might impact a student in the college setting. So I work with those students on thinking through their needs as they're transitioning to college and supporting them in developing self-advocacy skills and identifying holistic accommodations. So beyond academic accommodations, thinking about residential accommodations, transportation, sort of looking at continuity of care and other needs they might have if they're living on a college campus. And the reason I do this is because colleges provide varying levels of supports for students with physical disabilities and health conditions, and every college looks a little bit different, and every student's situation can look a little bit different. And so I got into this work because I used to be the associate director of the Disability Support Office at Georgetown University, where I specifically worked with students with health conditions and physical disabilities, undergraduate, graduate, and medical school students. So I bring that lens to my work now of sort of understanding university processes and how university administrators might be looking at a student's documentation and working with students. And that is really helpful piece to have in my back pocket when I'm working with students so I can guide them through the process and prepare them for that transition to college.
Yeah, and I bet just having that experience does give you a guide for helping students. And I think as a parent, and I have three, and my oldest just went to college, you don't know what you don't know, but I would think that there are times that you do more for a student that you may not recognize that you're doing in general. And so just in terms of that college transition piece is huge, right? Your baby's leaving the nest, but then if you have this layers of a physical or a health condition that the adult now, because they're typically 18 and older, would need support with, what steps could I take as a parent of a student with either physical or health conditions or both to start that transition process? Like, what do you wish parents knew before they call you like mid-December of their senior year of high school?
Well, hopefully they've called me before that, but I take people as they come and when they come. But something you said that was really, really important, and I think a lot of people don't realize it until the time is upon them, the shadow work that parents do, right? So I am a parent too. I understand that like we want the trains to run on time. Sometimes it's easier for me to do something for my daughter than to wait for her to do it herself, right? And I think every parent experiences that, and you're just like, do the thing. And then you end up doing it for them, right? And one of the challenges that occurs because of those habits that we develop as parents and then our students or our children develop those habits too of that dependency, which they might not even realize, is happening, right? They might not even recognize all of the shadow work that parents and guardians are doing to keep things moving in the house. So I often work with students and families to talk about what are the things that the parents are doing behind the scenes, whether that's medication refills or making doctor's appointments or, preparing the student's lunch for them every day and putting it in their backpack. What are those things that families are doing for the student? Identifying them, sometimes naming them. Sometimes the student is like, what? I didn't even know that all of these things were just happening. I just thought my medication appeared in front of me every day. Magically, there's a fairy that comes and drops it off and on my plate. And so some of it is just like an awareness, right? I don't expect like most teenagers to have that sort of awareness of all of the things that are happening around them. So sometimes gradually bringing them into the conversation to say like, this is how this medication got here today. And here are the steps that I had to do to do that refill. So I knew you were going to need a refill every 30 days. 10 days ago, I had a calendar notice on my phone, and then I went ahead and did the refill right there online. Bringing the student into the conversation as early as possible can be really helpful so that they can start to wrap their brains around what that means. also lengthening the leash a little bit so that students can start to develop some of those adulting skills that they might need, like food preparation. I have a friend who has her 10-year-old daughter make dinner for herself once a week. The kid eats a lot of grilled cheese, but the habit that they're establishing is like that dependent that the student doesn't need to depend on the parent to be able to do those things. So she's learning, you know, life skills. So thinking about what are the shadow work that families are doing, and how can you start to bring the students into those things? And sometimes actually creating that list, writing it out, is a good starting point. And then you can start to chip away on how do we address these things so that the student can start to take these pieces on.
Then how do you, and I might be jumping ahead here, then how do you help guide the families to really kind of advocating for themselves, obviously at school, but just I'm thinking some folks are going to need appointments when they're at school. So how do you navigate that with a student that's looking for schools that may have one or more than one medical appointments that they do locally in their community, and that they may need to transfer those to where they are, or have somebody oversee that? So how do you kind of have that conversation with the parent? Because those are things that people may or may not even think about in terms of like medical appointments, and then having the students taking that ownership for those conversations with the physician of how they're feeling, and then being able to communicate back to the parent of what took place or what transpired, because the parent's not going to be in that meeting anymore, not meeting, appointment.
Yes. And you make a really great point. It's a huge shift. The transition to adulthood sort of medically is a challenging, you know, path for everyone, right? There's a lot of transition, both for the student, for the young adult, and for the parent, right? Because you've been, as a parent, you've maybe been taking the reins for 18 years, and it's hard sometimes to let go of those reins, right? And so it's a complex kind of thing that we have to navigate here. So when we're talking about this continuity of care piece, there's a couple elements. So the first element is that once the student turns 18, they're an adult, technically. Well, they might not have all of the adult skills that we might like them to have. They are technically an adult. They are considered an adult in the eyes of the law. So with each of their healthcare providers, the student would need to sign a waiver to allow the parent to then have access to their health information, or to be privy to those doctor's notes or whatever the doctor puts in the chart. So that should be a conversation between the student and the parent. Most healthcare providers will prompt that conversation if they see a student is going to turn 18 soon, but sometimes it doesn't come up and the parents just get cut off, and that's that. So if that's something that you want to have access to, you should talk about it with your student, talk about the pros and the cons, and figure it out independently. If your student is going to a college that is maybe out of state, there are a lot more pieces to talk about. If they're on your insurance, you have to consider some of the insurance issues related to that. If your student has a mental health care provider that they work with in their home state, you have to look at licensure issues to see if that person can provide care either via telehealth or Zoom or, you know, video calls. They may or may not be licensed in that other state. They may or may not be able to provide care in that other state. If your student has specific healthcare conditions, maybe they get shots, infusions, transfusions, or need like, you know, care while the time they are away at school, you might also be looking at transitioning care to another provider that's close to that school. And actually, some of the people who I work with like look at their school search, they conduct their college search based on healthcare facilities that are nearby. So if they have a specific condition, they might be looking at a university that is close to a medical center that has providers that work with clients with that specific condition. And that's a kind of a common thing if you have a condition that needs more oversight, or if you know you're thinking, or if you have a rare disease and you're thinking about doctors that work within that community, that is sometimes how people center their college searches. So there's a lot of moving parts with that, and I work with families to sort of think through what are all the pieces that we want to factor in, what are the important pieces, and how do we get to a place where everybody feels comfortable. And sometimes students will also say that they only want to go like 2 hours away from home so that they can have easier access to keep their same healthcare providers, because that might be advantageous in some way or make it easier for them. So Yes. So in sum, lots of moving parts, Wendy, and lots to think through. And that is what I help people sort of navigate and think through.
And layering that on with just finding the right fit of a school as well, how do you help families kind of think of that collaboration piece? Like, is there a collaboration piece between the young adult, the parent, the university, and anybody else that's medically on their team? Does that ever come into play when you're helping families?
Yes. And finding the right school is, you know, a challenge for everybody, right? Like, this is that whole college search thing. So when I'm working with clients, I'm not a college consultant, but I often work alongside a college consultant or a high school counselor. So students usually have a high school counselor that they're working with on the college search process. They might also have an independent educational consultant, a college consultant who's guiding them in that search process. I typically say that students should start their search process just like any other student, right? So looking at major, at the sort of school culture that they want, you know, the vibe that they want on campus, the things that they want to be engaged in, this sort of urban rural situation. What do you want? What are you looking for? So starting your search just like everybody else. Then we have this like added layer of thinking through, maybe it's physical accessibility. Maybe it's also access to healthcare providers. That's like another piece of that puzzle. The next sort of phase of this too is vetting the disability support offices. So I mentioned before that every school, every college provides accommodations for students with disabilities. Students are required to request accommodations themselves. So that means they have to self-disclose to the disability support office, which could have a different name: accessibility services, student disability services, student access center, all kinds of names. So that student has to connect with that office, provide documentation, have a conversation, get approved for accommodations, and then the student would be responsible for connecting with each of their professors to talk about their accommodations. Before you even get there, you want to make sure that the student is selecting a school where they know they will be supported, where they know that people will do their best to work with them and assist them. And because every college is a little bit different in how they provide accommodations and the support in which they provide along with those accommodations, it's important to get a sense of who the people are in the office and how they approach their job. I often recommend that families look at the mission statements of the disability support offices to see the scope and breadth of the work that they may or may not do there. Some universities are very compliance focused, right? So the ADA, the Americans with Disabilities Act, is the law that governs accommodations, reasonable accommodations in higher education. And many schools will just provide what they have to provide legally, whereas other schools might go beyond providing required accommodations and might think about the students' needs more holistically. And so That just varies a little bit, and you have to do your research ahead of time to know essentially what you're buying, because you're purchasing a college education, right? And you wouldn't go into purchasing, you know, a car without test driving it, or a house without maybe doing a walkthrough. So you want to know what you're getting before you actually say yes.
You brought up an excellent point about ADA. As families are listening, they are very accustomed to IEPs and the federal law that governs a 504 and IEP. How does that transition? Can you just kind of walk us through that as a family that's had a student within, you know, the pre-K through 12 system, and they've received support at their school, and now they're going to a university? And what does that look like with the transition of law?
Sure. So IDEA, the Individuals with Disabilities Education Act, that's the law that governs K through 12 education. That's the law that gives us IEPs. And that is mostly in public school settings, right? So a student who goes to a public school, like, who maybe has a learning disability, maybe also a physical disability or a health condition as well, especially if they have co-occurring conditions, they might also have an IEP. An IEP includes services as well as accommodations. It might also include modifications. If a student has a 504 plan, that's under Section 504 of the Rehabilitation Act, and that's an anti-discrimination act. It's meant to reduce barriers and give students access to education. So your student might have a 504 plan in a public school as well. That also applies to private K through 12 schools. When a student goes to college, there's a big shift. So the IDEA kind of goes out the door, and that part of Section 504 that applies to high schools goes out the door. IEPs and 504 plans do not transition with a student to college. This is a common myth. We need to dispel this myth. Sometimes parents think that if their student has an IEP, they should get them on a 504 plan once they're a senior in high school because 504 applies to college. That's not true. Don't do that. You don't need to do that.
I feel like there's a collective gasp happening now.
Yes. Yeah. I am here to shock people on this anniversary episode. Yeah. I mean, I think it's a common thing. I see it so all over the place in Facebook groups and things where parents are just perpetuating this myth, right? And then there's Mythbusters who come in to say that's not true. So when a student transitions to college, the ADA becomes the law of accommodations. Section 504 does apply to college, but it's a different subsection of the law that applies to higher education. And I think this is maybe where this kernel of misinformation has come out, because people say, oh, 504 applies to college. That means the 504 plan goes to college. Not true. In college, you have an accommodation plan and you get an accommodation letter. And so your accommodations that you received in the high school setting might be similar to what you get in college, but they will likely not be exactly the same. And that's because the ADA provides reasonable accommodations, and I'm doing air quotes here, reasonable accommodations. And what is reasonable can be determined sort of based on the program that the student is in, the physical space of the campus. It sort of depends on the individual's requests for accommodations, what they're looking for and what they've asked for. And that's a really important piece too. So students are required to request accommodations. So every college has their own documentation guidelines, their own process for students to request accommodations, and that can look a little bit different. At some colleges, they might actually ask for a copy of the student's 504 plan or their IEP because it's good supplementary information for the disability support office to have so they can see what sorts of accommodations a student got in the high school setting. But that doesn't mean that they'll do a one-to-one translation to the college accommodations. It's also really important for people to know that colleges don't do modifications. So when a student transitions to college, they have to be able to meet the same academic level and rigor as every other student. So typically, modifications are not a part of a college accommodation. So if your student has a modification for doing less math problems or, you know, alternate assignments, they could ask individual professors if they'd be willing to do something like that, but that would not likely show up in an accommodation letter in a college setting. Also, services are not a part of college accommodations either. So if your student gets a one-on-one aide, a paraeducator, a support person who's with them during the day, maybe that's because they use a wheelchair or they have another type of physical disability or condition where they need someone, that's not provided in college either. Occupational therapy, physical therapy, speech therapy, not provided in college either. So those are all big changes that families may not be totally aware of. And that's why it's really important to start this process early, to start to wrap your brains around what supports is my student going to need and how are we going to ensure that they have what they need and they're finding the right school setting for them.
You brought up a good point in terms of one-to-one aid in a school setting, in a secondary setting. How would that look like in a college setting? Like if you needed an aide for access or feeding or just anything, what does that translate to?
So first you have to think about like, what is the function of the aide? What are they doing? What does the student need support with? If it's activities of daily living, like eating, dressing, bathing, getting things out of their bag, most likely that would mean that the student has a mobility impairment, a physical disability, and so they need that support. If a student needs that support in the college setting, they would have to hire their own personal care attendant. And this is actually something I work with a lot of students on. I have a lot of students who have physical disabilities, and I have a partnership with the Christopher and Dana Reeve Foundation, so students with paralysis can work with me for free. And so we will make sure to drop that in the notes. But you know, if a student needs to hire a PCA or a number of PCAs, that looks a little bit different for every student. It kind of depends on what their needs are. Some students have to have a registered nurse or an LPN because there are some medical components to this. They might be using an agency to be like a home health agency to do that. Other students might just need more sort of basic levels of support and care. They might hire other students or an individual, but it's really important that students and families start thinking about that early because there is a price tag associated with that as well. So depending on the type of care that the student needs, it can get really expensive. And there's one school that provides sort of comprehensive personal care support in the US, and that's University of Illinois Champaign-Urbana. And they have a dormitory where students can get 5 hours of personal care attendant support. And then they can hire the individual students who work as PCAs there to help them out outside of that time. Wright State in Dayton, Ohio has a personal care attendant kiosk where students can kind of go into the student center and get help with personal care needs during daytime hours. But everywhere else, and there's about 4,500 colleges in the United States, a student would have to hire and manage their own personal care attendants during that time, which can be new and sometimes challenging for students. And I've written a ton about this too, so we'll make sure to put those links in the show notes so people can see that.
Yeah, and just understanding that, and then it kind of just brings us back to what we were talking about when we first started in terms of lengthening that leash, to so to say, so that students can start to navigate some of this independently. Or to see, okay, what do we need to prioritize and how do we start looking and getting that support? How can I, either as the young adult or the parent, help facilitate identifying and requesting the necessary accommodations that I might need when I'm on campus?
Yeah. So usually I let the young adults know ahead of time that they should be asking about the accommodations and asking questions, ideally prior to applying to the school and absolutely before committing, because once you've said yes, you're in, you got to make it work. Once you've committed and you sign that dotted line, then we're in a different situation where we're trying to make things work from that point on. A better situation to be in is to actually gather the information ahead of time to inform your decision. So usually when I work with students, we actually sit down and think about what are the accommodations you would need in the classroom? What would you need in a testing setting? What accommodations might you need in the residential setting, in dining, in recreation, for transportation? And we go through sort of all of those areas of life. And then from there, we craft questions for the disability support offices so that the student can set up a time to connect with them and essentially interview them to see sort of what their experience is like. I find it's better to use scenario-based questions, so I encourage students to do that. Because most disability support offices will tell you something that sounds like this: we will provide ADA accommodations and work with the students once we review their documentation, right? And so that doesn't give you a ton of information because it just doesn't. It's just not a very informative response. It's a totally fine response, but it's not a very informative response. So sometimes if you use hypothetical situations, scenarios, like, and ask them what they've done in the past for a student with XYZ condition, they might give you a little bit more insight into how they approach a situation or what things they have provided, which could inform you to better understand what the student may or may not get once they have committed to the school.
And you recommend doing that prior to applying?
Oh, yeah.
Okay.
A lot of people think that they should not or cannot reach out to the disability support office prior to applying. That's not true. The disability support office can choose whether or not they reply to you. That's for sure. But
that's an answer within itself, right?
Yeah, I think you can glean data from all of these sources, right? So it's important for families to understand that the admissions department is totally separate from the disability support office, because this sort of goes into this disclosure piece where, you know, I get this question a lot, like, should I disclose before I get into the school, all of these things. So first fact is that the disability office is separate from the admissions office. So that's really important for people to know. So if you connect with the disability support office, they're not getting on the phone and talking to admissions. That's just not happening. Universities are very siloed, intentionally in many cases like this, and that would be blatant discrimination, right? So that's not happening. Highly likely also that the admissions department is not calling up the disability office to say, we just read this person's personal statement and it says that they use a power wheelchair. Do you know them? They're not doing that. That's not happening. So it's really important for students to sort of understand that you know, how those silos work and why they are in place, right? So you're not allowed to discriminate against a student because they disclose a disability. So that's a big piece of the puzzle. Most people then ask about just disclosure, like, should I disclose in my application? Or what is that? You know, what does that look like? I always say that that's sort of a personal decision. It sort of depends on, you know, what is the story that the student is telling and how are they telling the story, right? So it's really important for students to sort of think about that as they're writing personal statements. There's also a section on the Common App too, where if your student has had time off school, maybe they've had multiple surgeries, or maybe they've taken time off because of their health condition. There's a little section where you can sort of disclose those pieces, because if there are gaps in, you know, in a student's educational record, the college might be like, why is there a gap here? It looks like this person took 6 months off. What happened there? And so you might be disclosing, you know, in that section too, that you took time off because you were in the hospital for whatever thing or had a surgery. So I think like that piece is a personal choice about whether or not you want to disclose in the personal essay. But in general, there's no required checkbox that says, do you have a disability, yes or no, on a college application. There might be a checkbox that you can choose to check about disability status. And sometimes that informs scholarships for that school. You can always call the admissions department and say, where is that data being used? What is that informing? And, you know, they'd have to answer that. So, you know, I think like this is just one of those things. I think colleges nowadays are looking for diverse applicant pools and trying to figure out how they can get that information given, you know, the recent Supreme Court case. So I think disability is an aspect of diversity on campus. And I think, you know, that could be a plus for your student to disclose, but ultimately it's the student's choice what they want to talk about.
So when a student is in K through 12, we know that accommodations need to be met and there's a channel and following when accommodations are not met. What does that mean for a student in the university or college setting to ensure that the effective implementation of accommodations?
Yeah, this is a tricky one and a huge shift. Essentially, the onus is on the student to inform if they are not receiving the accommodations that they have been approved for. So I mentioned that the Disability Support Office approves the accommodations. So it might be the student might have an accommodation letter that looks a little bit like an IEP, not nearly as thorough. It just goes through what the accommodations are. So it might say things like time and a half on exams, a note taker for classes, preferential seating, classroom relocation for accessible buildings, whatever the accommodations that have been approved are. It does not say what the student's condition is. So from there, the student then is supposed to connect with each of their professors. So some schools have systems where the professor will get an email that outlines the accommodations that the student should receive in that class. Some schools have students give their professors a physical letter that outlines the accommodations, but the professor knows nothing about the student. So they don't know, you know, if the student has a learning disability, if they have a chronic health condition that's invisible, if they have a mental health condition. Unless the student has a visible physical disability, you know, the professor has no idea what the student's condition is. And so the student is then supposed to go and have a conversation with each of the professors about how the accommodations will work in the class. That is often a very intimidating process for young adults. I usually coach people on creating talking points, elevator pitches, so that they feel more comfortable in those conversations. And that can be really helpful for people to do ahead of time and sort of practice those conversations. But if the professor is not giving the accommodations, sometimes the professor has forgotten that the student needs something. So a friendly reminder might be like in order in that case. In other cases, if the professor, you know, says, oh, we don't do that here. I don't provide extra time. We don't, you know, I don't do that. then you would want to, the student would need to go back to the disability support office and involve them in a conversation with the professor and maybe the department head or whoever else needs to be communicated with. But students have to be the ones to identify that there's a problem, to find the right people to connect with, and then to work to solve the problem. Whereas in high school, maybe a parent or a guardian was doing that background shadow advocacy for them. And so this is a big adjustment for students. It's also a little bit challenging sometimes, and students can have a little bit of self-advocacy fatigue because they have to constantly remind the professors, maybe they're in five classes, about what their needs are, about what their accommodations are, about what they've agreed to. And so that can be a little challenging sometimes for students to have to stay on top of that and manage all of their other life and classes and social life and healthcare needs and whatnot. So it's really important that students have good strategies in place to be able to manage all of those pieces.
It's a lot to manage. I mean, it's a lot. What advice do you have for students that may be feeling that fatigue of managing that layer along with the academics and the social and the just independent living and being away and all of it?
Yeah, it's really complicated. And especially, you know, I support a lot of students with chronic health conditions that have sort of limited amounts of energy, right? And there's a limited amount of time in your day. And how are you spending your time? If students can find ways to sort of automate some of these things. So sometimes it's as simple as like coming up with canned emails so that if you're having a flare, or if something's wrong, you just sort of copy and paste, creating systems, right? It's still work, but it's like mitigating the effort, right? And then thinking about, are there other things that you can sort of automate in your life, whether that's, you know, getting some help or assistance with housework or chores. I have students who I work with who actually like have other students do their laundry or, you know, like work out so that, you know, they have another student who helps them clean or take some of the things off of their plate. But good executive function skills help, and having calendars and reminders. I would also say that different schools sort of approach these things in different ways. So if you're choosing a school that maybe has more students that have chronic health conditions, if you have a chronic health condition, or you know a number of students who have gone through that same program who have a similar condition to what you have, chances are that professors will be more attuned to the needs of those students. And so, you know, that could be a factor in your college search process too. So you can look at that. Another way to sort of vet how things are going on that campus is to search the student newspaper too. Put in key terms in the student newspaper, accessibility, disability, you know, whatever the thing is, whatever condition or thing, mental health, and see what comes up. And you might see what students are venting about. And that could be informative too for your search process. But, you know, there is no good sort of catch-all solution to self-advocacy fatigue. The way that the law is set up requires the student to self-advocate, and the onus really is on the student to make sure that they're getting what they need. And I think, you know, that is a piece of this puzzle too. If you know that your student is really going to struggle with that, maybe they're taking a reduced course load so that they don't have as many classes, or maybe you're finding other ways to put some of those other systems in place so that they don't have to worry about some of the other things, but it's really tricky.
It is tricky. And I do think a component that helps, and it's kind of been a theme through our conversations and just other podcasts, is having students start early and advocate for themselves within their secondary education, as, you know, whenever they're at an age that the family and they feel comfortable to speak to their teacher and to be a part of that IEP meeting and to start having that opportunity to practice, and even just making phone calls ahead of time and scheduling appointments ahead of time and really allowing that space for that student to, you know, show them how to look up the phone number and how to actually speak on the phone and in full sentences when you're, you know, not texting or any, you know, just starting to be able to make appointments for yourself and to have those conversations as early as possible so yep. that it makes it easier once you are needing to be more independent.
Yep. Yeah, I agree 110%. Sometimes it can be helpful for a family to reach out to a service provider like a therapist or a family coach or someone like you, Wendy, or someone like me to engage to be a third party in this process because, parent-child relationships can be fraught sometimes. And so it's important to know, like, if you recognize that you're not going to be able to do this as an independent family unit, then finding those support systems, either at school or out in the community, is going to be key for you and for the student to start to figure out how all of these things are going to fall into place.
Yeah, and I would even say just that in a doctor's appointment, having your student start to speak for themselves and have the physician looking at your student as if they are that young adult and get the information from them, because oftentimes parents want to kind of own that conversation. And as you said, that shadow work and start to say, well, they're feeling this and this, but start to have that student articulate what they're thinking and feeling independently from the parent. And that sometimes does need a third person to have that conversation, because it's hard when it's your baby and you have fear and love and you're used to being that parent that's doing the work, and then to slowly start to have them take ownership.
Yeah, it's tricky. You could also talk to the doctor too and see if they would be willing to meet with the child independently first and then bring you into the room later. So sometimes students will step up when they have to and will actually share things and might actually, like it that mom or dad is not in the room, when they're in this appointment. So there are some easy ways. I also think like preparing for doctor's appointments is an important piece too. So, like talking to the student, like, okay, this is what you've shared with me. Why don't we write it down? Here, write it down, put it in your phone, put your bullets in, bring your phone with you to the appointment, and literally read them to the doctor, right? If you think like you're gonna forget this stuff or whatever, like just read it. Oh, here are the things that I thought of before I came in and I wanted to tell you about it. Some of
Isn't
those
that helpful for
skills.
all of us?
Yeah, right? I mean, that's what I do. So. And it helps because then you're like, okay, this was the thing I wanted to mention. So I've got it right here. So those are just good life skills and good strategies to employ. I think you're totally right, Wendy. And I think it's a process and we all have to lean into the discomfort of these processes. And it's not always going to be easy and it will benefit you in the long run and it'll benefit the student too.
And I would just want to add one little quick thing to that before I ask you another question, is also having your student practice writing an email to their teacher, and as young as possible. I've had them start even in elementary school, just emailing their teacher if they have a question or concern, just so they're in that practice of proper writing and addressing an adult, but then also communicating whatever that need may be.
That's a really important thing that you just shared because colleges run, everything's on email. Students get emails all the time, professors email students, there's email. Email is a thing. They may not have that same sort of email relationship in the high school setting. So getting them prepped for college and beyond, right? I mean, the workplace is a very email focused place in many workplaces. So that's really important for them to have those skills and to actually walk through the process of doing a greeting in the first line of the email, then going into your question, then actually saying something nice at the end, and then, signing your full name, like sincerely so and so, because a lot of students go right to the question, or they'll just write the question with no salutation. And, it's not as nice to get an email that just says, like, what do I have to do for this? It's much nicer to get an email, even though it seems silly. And I know it feels indirect to people, but it is much nicer to receive an email that has, a starting sentence that's kind, a question, and then, an ending kindness. So.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And that can go for everybody. So back to medication for a moment, because that's a scary thing for parents, right? Because what medication, having the student know what the medication is for and how to take it, when to take it, how to get the refills, can be an anxiety producing scenario for families. So how can either the parent or the student address concerns related to, are you taking your meds? Are there potential side effects? And how does that all apply to how your support with students?
Yeah. So unless the parent's plan is to physically show up every day at the student's dorm and ensure that they've taken the medication, place it in their mouths, you need a plan, right? So a lot of times students and families will start to use apps. There's tons of apps now. It's also really easy to ignore apps and reminders, depending on the type of student that you have or the type of person that you are. So, you know, some people go old school and use pill boxes, right? Like there are innovations that we have put in place that can help us sort of organize these pieces. There are even pill dispensers now that are Wi-Fi enabled. So you pre-populate all of your pills for the week. And then at, you know, 9 a.m. every day, it shoots out of the thing and it tracks whether or not you've lifted it up because it's all techie and cool. So you got to figure out like what strategy is going to work for your student so that they can do this independently. The other piece of that too is like most of the apps have like a tracker so you can put in like, how is this making me feel? Or, you know, just put in like little notes about the medication and how things are going. A lot of students now will use sort of like speech to text and stuff. So I always tell students, like, even if you're not using an app, like just open up the notes app on your phone, or, you know, if you're not using a medication tracking app, just open up your text message or open up something, open up an email and just like verbally say in there what's going on. And then you have that record. So there's that piece, right? Like the taking of the medication, your student still has to be able to fill the pill box to, you know, to know which medications there are. I usually work with students to create lists of all of their medication, the dosage, the doctor who has prescribed it and why they're taking it. Usually having that in like a Google Doc or something that is alive and can be modified as things change can be helpful. And also, if they happen to have to go to a doctor or have to go to a hospital, then they can have Google Doc open on their phone and just have it right there. What, you know, what medications are you taking? And then they can just tell them because they have a list. And so that can be really helpful too. The other piece of this too, the refill situation, is it really is different for every student in every school. So some colleges have pharmacies as a part of their student health services where students can get refills right there on campus. Some colleges don't, and you might have to transfer a prescription to, you know, nearby pharmacy and the student might have to go and get it. Some students do delivery, but every college is different in how mail works. So sometimes it goes to a central processing place and then it gets pushed out to a student. So there might be a delay. Or if your student's medication requires refrigeration, that probably won't work for them. You have to connect and sort of figure out how mail works at that school. So you have to look at the individual college, what's around and how people are doing that. You know, if you're using a pharmacy like a Walgreens, a Rite Aid, a CVS, they all have apps now. So you can get a notification when your prescription is running out, when you need to reach out to your doctor. You know, when it's ready, it'll alert you. So there are some like structures that you might want to put in place there for your student. But if your student's taking a regulated substance, right? So if they are on a psychotropic medication, if they're taking something like Adderall, Ritalin, something that's only given in smaller prescription sizes, if they're going out of state to school, that may or may not travel with them. So they may or may not be able to put that prescription into a pharmacy because their doctor from Maryland may not be able to prescribe and get a prescription filled in New York State. So you have to check on some of those pieces. So it might also be that you have to figure out a system so the student continues to get their medication in their home state and then somehow gets the medication to them when they need it in college. But thinking about that ahead of time is key. Because once they get there and they hit the ground running and they're going out and they're having fun and they're studying and they're doing all the things that they're supposed to be doing, sometimes these things fall to the wayside. And then a student ends up in October and doesn't have any more meds left. And then it's midterms and it's crisis. So it's really important that you've figured that out before you get to that point.
What resources do you recommend for families to help ease this transition? We've talked about some, but what have we not addressed?
Yeah, it kind of depends on what the student's condition or conditions are. I think right now I'm seeing a lot more like youth, young adult supports out there where other students who are in college now are talking about their experience with X condition at their college. And I do think that there is some really beneficial support in having like other people who are experiencing similar conditions and are going through similar situations to get that sort of firsthand experience and to understand that you're not alone. Because many of the students I work with feel like I'm the only one who has XYZ thing and is going through this, and I have to assure them that they're not. So that like, well, their experience might be unique to their individual situation and the school that they're in now. You know, college could be a place to sort of reinvent or to see who you are in this new adult context, right? So there are a lot more, you know, sort of disability activists, advocates, college age students sharing their experiences on Instagram and on TikTok. So students might want to look at some of those things. And then there are sort of more like formalized groups, foundations, organizations that have like young adult, college age, peer sort of support groups and information sessions too. Because I do think that that is a piece of this that doesn't get talked about a lot. We often talk about like parents preparing and all of these things, but students need to prepare as well. And like they might need a different sort of preparation than the parents need, right? To hear about like the peer experience. So I think that that piece is important.
Yeah, absolutely. And that's, I'm glad you brought that up and even figuring that out before you start applying to make sure, like you think you'd mentioned earlier, just the vibe of the campus aligns with your vibe as a student and that you're wanting to be there and you're feeling comfortable being there.
Many of the students that I'm working with now actually are actively looking for disability-related organizations on campus. So whether it's a student organization, a club, or there are now colleges that have disability cultural centers. I think there's like 12 or 15 in the US now, which is separate from a disability support office and is more of an identity space, like a women's center, an LGBTQIA center, or a multicultural student center. So they have more activities and sort of like groups and meeting spaces specific to the disability identity and what it means to be, you know, disabled in the college context and the history of disability in the United States. So I think, you know, your student might be into that, they might not, but sometimes just knowing like what options are available at that school, should they choose to want to, you know, explore that part of their identity, can be really helpful to know in advance what's there. So that could be something that someone's looking into when they're exploring colleges.
You had mentioned executive function. So how could I assist my student kind of developing those skills, whether it's time management, study skills, because that, although you may have a foundation as you transition to college, that looks a little bit different in some areas.
Well, everybody can hire you and your team to support them, Wendy, with developing those executive function skills. But if they can't do that, then, you know, it's really important that students have good organization in place. So the ability to use a calendar. Google Calendar is a simple one. A lot of colleges use it anyway. So having a calendar, having a set structure and plan so that they know each week on Sunday, they're sitting down and looking what's coming up for the week, making lists for themselves. These are all things that a lot of students do struggle with. When I was working in a university setting, I was also in charge of all the academic services. And this is an important thing too for people to know. Most colleges have at least a little bit of academic support structure put in there. So they might be able to meet with a coach at the school or a learning specialist to talk about strategies for college studying, organizational skills, time management. Some colleges also put on like workshops that students can attend too. So that could be a piece of the puzzle. Hopefully they're starting earlier than the first semester in college. But yeah, I think that the creating a calendar, setting expectations and setting and working with your student to develop good sort of time management and executive function strategies is going to be really important because there's a lot more free time in college and it's really easy to get swept up in and not, you know, not do your homework or not do your reading because you had this 4-hour patch of time between your first class and your next class. And before you know it, you've played Fortnite for 4 hours. So you need to have a structure in place because mom or dad are not there to say, put down your Fortnite and do your reading. So that's going to be really critical for students to have those structures. And some colleges too, if your student has a learning disability, ADD, autism, there are supplementary support programs. Some of them are pay for service where you can have a coach meet with your student a couple times a week, once a week. Those exist now. And I think you've had Eric Enlich on your show before, Wendy, so people can go back to that episode. And Eric maintains a list of learning disability and autism support programs on his website for all the states. So you can see what programs exist. And that could be a beneficial resource if you know your student's going to need more touch points. So you could look into that too.
Yeah, thanks for that plug. As we wind down, what did I not know enough to ask that I should have asked you?
Well, I want to, speaking of plugs, I want to plug a great resource that I created. I started a course, an online course that's really fantastic for parents, for educators, for healthcare providers on preparing students with physical disabilities and health conditions for college. And so folks can go to my website, and which is accessiblecollege.com, and click on the top toolbar. It says course, and you can learn more about the course. It's multi-module. There are some bonus modules. They are bite-sized, 20 minutes or less videos. You can also opt into one-on-one calls with me or small group calls too. And it's a great starting point for people who are starting to think about some of the skills and pieces that their students are going to need. So it goes over accommodations, continuity of care, independent living, all of the things, talking to the disability support office. So if you're new to this, that could be a much more achievable entry point for you to sort of get this information in a way that works for you. I also have a Facebook group called College Success, Physical Disabilities, Chronic Health, and Mental Health. And I co-admin that with two college consultants. One is Scott Markin, and he works specifically with students with mental health conditions and autism spectrum disorders. And also with Adrian Frumberg, who is a college consultant who works with students with learning disabilities, substance abuse disorders, physical disabilities, and chronic health conditions too. And it's a great place to just ask questions, to learn more about sort of current trends. So I would suggest that people connect with that group. And then I also have tons of social media things happening. So people can follow me on Instagram and Twitter and Facebook. I have a Facebook page too, to see sort of what's going on with me. I do a lot of webinars and events that people can engage with and learn more about, specifically students with physical disabilities and chronic health conditions going to college.
Tremendous resource. And we're going to put all those links in our show notes. And I have to say that I did have a wonderful opportunity to go through your course. And if anybody listening should take a peek at it, because Annie does a phenomenal job of breaking things down and just chunks that you're able to absorb. You don't feel overwhelmed. And then she's always available to check in. So that's my plug back.
Thanks, Wendy. I appreciate that.
Yeah. So last question, if you had a billboard for a parent or actually a young adult, what would be your advice on that billboard?
Oh my gosh, that's complicated. I guess, I mean, this is going to sound a little cliche, especially since like we've just talked about this, but start early was probably what my billboard would say. Because we are all developing these skills like through life, right? And some of this is like resiliency, life skills, and just, you know, adulting. And so if your student is starting these things out early, or if you're a parent and you're trying to get your student to start these things out early, the earlier that you get started, the better the chances are that they'll have all the tools in their toolbox once they actually fly the nest. And so that's going to be really important for families. So yeah, start early is my billboard.
And I think that goes for every kid. Start early. Start early with that transition. Well, Annie, this was such a pleasure. Thank you for doing a tour with me on the podcast and coming back on. As always, great information and insight, and we'll put all those links in the show notes. So thank you.
Thank you, Wendy.
You bet. Thank you for joining us today with the Special Ed Strategist podcast. Again, I am your host, Wendy Taylor. Today's episode certainly shed some light on the intricate process of preparing for college with physical disabilities and health conditions. Remember, early preparation and proactive communication are keys to successful transition. If you still have questions, don't forget to check out Annie's course. You can find that link in our show notes. Join us next time as we continue to explore support for students with disabilities. Don't forget to like, follow, and share our podcast and join the conversation on Instagram at Learning Essentials. Bye for now.